Well, of course, it's a subject about which I don't know a lot. What I do know, I enjoy. You'll discover that the Bible, which is the instrument of peace, is very often the sword of division. I'm not going to be poetic tonight, but I'll tell you that's the way it is. When the Bible enters a culture, the message of the Bible brings peace to the hearts of those who believe, brings the knowledge of salvation and blessing and forgiveness. But it greatly disturbs the society that isn't ready for that sort of thing, and that society often responds with anger. So it is that we've had countries where the Bible was brought and great blessing came, but the forces of the enemy reacted violently against it, and there was great anger and opposition to it. You discover that that's also true in Christian societies as soon as we retranslate, re-edit, or do anything else with the Bible. It seems we can hardly touch it without creating some kind of disturbance of a distant sort one way or another. So I've said the irony of it is the book which shows us love and peace is very often the book that creates great difficulties among us as we thrash back and forth. The present setting in Bible translation is that there are about 50 different versions you can buy at any reasonable bookstore today. Just about 50. I can't give you an exact count. The last time I had an exact count, it was 43, but that was 4 years ago. So some have probably gone out and others have come in. Just about half the scholars I know are putting out a Bible translation of their own, which will be vastly superior to anything that's been done so far. They'll have to pay for the publication themselves in most cases. Just all sorts of things. And of course, if you pick up the advertising literature in these Bible translations, everyone is the very best. Everyone makes the other obsolete. I got a letter from a fellow in the Navy. He was out at sea. He was witnessing to his friend. And I don't know how far he was getting, but he was witnessing to his friend anyhow. And then his friend came on an advertisement in a magazine which upset them both. It advertised a particular Bible. It said, "You really haven't understood the Bible till you've read this Bible." And it went on and on and on. He sent me a photocopy of this that they'd made in the ship, and he said, "What can I say?" He said, "The Bible I have," he didn't have a King James, incidentally, but he said, "The Bible I have, is it really reliable? Is it any good?" And so forth. And I wrote him the best letter I could, pointing out that the Word of God is not destroyed, even by very poor translators. We want to keep it honest, we want to do the best we can, but I have seen people led to the Lord through some of the strangest Bibles, like the Cotton Patch version. So when we get right down to it, we sometimes get irritated on things that maybe we'd be better not to be irritated on. Well, I picked up this book last summer. Somebody was throwing it out, and I picked it up. That's the way I've gotten a great many of my books, and then when they throw it out and I pick it up, I try to sell it for a handsome price later on. Like a quarter. But I picked this book up last summer, and I was fascinated when I saw that the title of it, let me read the title as soon as I can get to the title page, the title of it by a man named Wilton Fulk. It's entitled, "A Defense of the Sincere and True Translations of the Holy Scriptures into the English Tongue Against the Cavalrous Remarks of Gregory Martin." That's the full title of it. It's by William Fulk, Master of Pembroke Hall in Cambridge. I went to work and looked up William Fulk. You know, I've taught history for a good while, church history, but if you think you hear of all these guys, you're just crazy. And when I read his name, I didn't have any idea who he was. My first dictionary I picked up didn't even mention him. But then I went on to more perceptive dictionaries and found out that he was a scholar in the 16th and 16th century, and that he had done a great deal of work in Bible translation. He'd been a defender of Tyndale and a bunch of other things like that, died happy at the age of about 68. And Gregory Martin, I did know Gregory Martin, I felt good about that. Gregory Martin was one of the chief translators of the Douay Rheims version. He had been an English Protestant who fled to France, became a Catholic, and he was one of the chief men. I'd never read anything by him except the Douay Rheims version, and it's been edited a lot of times since Gregory Martin's day. Now, I would be a great hypocrite if I told you I read every word in this massive tome, but I did read an awful lot of it. And what I discovered was that this is pre-King James, that Gregory Martin was raising the very same kind of objections to the English translations of Tyndale, Coverdale, the Bishops, and the Great Bible, and even the Geneva Bible, the very same type of objections that a lot of us fundamentalists raised against the RSV a few years ago, and that a lot of people raised against the King James and the NIV. And I said to myself, what is new under the sun? What is new under the sun? And the answer, of course, in Ecclesiastes is that in this term of human feeling and experience, nothing is new under the sun. So I said it might be interesting to go back and just see what people thought of the King James Bible in the day when it was issued. I had crossed that field in church history a little bit from time to time. I thought it would be an interesting study for me for no particular good reason. So I began moving in it, and then when Dr. Newman was good enough to ask me to fill in at Ibri again, I thought that would be a, I suggested it. And because IBRI is always pressed to get people to do these things, if you make a suggestion and they turn it down, it will be the first time. That isn't true, of course. I'm just saying it lightheartedly, because I have a lot of alternate views they don't want to hear in IBRI at all. But I've been kind of a literature man over the years, and I've enjoyed that because the Interdisciplinary Biblical Research Institution is not merely a test tube and a telescope association, but an association of believers who like to do scholarly things about the Bible and interact one discipline with the other. So against that, I offer a few notes of background material. I'll stay pretty close to these notes, but if I only read the notes, we'd be done in 5 minutes. I've got to fill them out a little bit with a story here or something like that. Now, the general note in English Bible translations through Wycliffe, and it is a very general note, is that most of them you would not be able to read if we gave them to you tonight. You would work all night long and not be able to preach. There weren't very many. There were not very many. His Venerable Beda did a fair amount of work. He died working in the Gospel of John. He was a good man and gave his life to the Lord in England in a time, long ago. How's that? Now, Piers the Plowman, that famous English poet that nobody knows anything about, translated a few psalms, apparently. We don't know if Piers did it or if the Plow did it, but whatever the case is, a few psalms were done by him. There were a few other franks and little fragments and scraps, too. St. Patrick did a little bit. If you don't want to say saint, just say Pat. He did a little bit, too, of translation into English. And a certain amount was done by other men in a kind of a random fashion, but there wasn't anything systematic done until the time of Alfred the Great, last half of the 9th century, about 970 to 1000 A.D. Alfred the Great was a religious, and I think a godly man. See, it's hard to go back and evaluate people's characters hundreds of years ago. It's hard to do it for today. But he certainly had the Bible interest at heart. And he had promised God that when he was king, he would defend the word of God and defend Great Britain and things like that. And so he himself did a fair amount of Bible translation and had a fair amount of other Bible translation work done. I've been able to look at photocopies of a lot of that stuff. I don't own those myself. And the English, of course, is Middle Saxon English, and you just might as well read Latin. That's what you might as well do. Once in a while you come on a word you know, but there's so much barbaric German, that means German just transliterated English. There's so much barbaric German, so much butchered Latin, that it really is a very difficult kind of study. Back in linguistic universities, they offer a whole course in Middle English just so guys can read it and can get ready for Chaucer. Relatively little was done to Wycliffe's time. There was a rumor of a Bible having been printed in England before Wycliffe's day. Sir Thomas More, writing 100 years after Wycliffe's time, would point out that there was no need for the Wycliffeite Bible since John Oxenham had produced the Bible. It was perfectly adequate well before him. But we don't even have a sentence from that Bible. We not only don't have any copies or fragments, we don't have so much as a sentence from it or a quotation from it. All we have is a notation by Thomas More and a couple other guys that it was done, and it should have been good enough. But it obviously wasn't good enough because not a fraction of it remains. Although if you should find it in your trunk at home, you'll be a rich person if you can prove that's what it is. You're fortunate you can quit work tomorrow, or as soon as you can get it to Sotheby's, you can quit work. It'll all be over. But Wycliffe came through and translated the Bible from Latin into English. We know that generally. And whether it was a great job or not is beside the point. Wycliffe did not know Greek. He was thorough in Latin. Greek was almost like a mystery right to him. He would have done well in our Greek 2 class, but that's about as far as he would have gone. The thrust in that is that English Bible translations before Wycliffe were very feeble. There was almost nothing to build on and very little to work with. That had been hampered by the fact that the linguistic skills of Greek and Hebrew had been lost in the Western world very much after 500 A.D., When we say lost, we don't mean they were totally gone, but they were certainly not known. The scholars up to 1200 A.D. in the Western world, the scholars who knew Greek were few. The scholars who knew Hebrew were a lot fewer yet, a great many fewer. Now, Greek itself was not widely known because they talked, they worked, they conversed in Latin. They knew some Greek, but relatively little Greek. And going through the schoolmen like Thomas Aquinas and all those fellows, you don't find many Greek scholars among them. Abelard didn't know any Greek at all. Anselm knew no Greek at all, as far as we know from their writings and from their own references. And Hebrew, and many of them thought that to study Hebrew was to put yourself at the ill disposition of the Jews. Who knows? You might get an attack of Haggadic fever or something like that if you got working with Hebrew. Those things have been rather lost. But starting in the 14th century, in the 1300s, there was a recovery. And in the 1500s, there was a major recovery, first of Hebrew, under the influence of Reuchlin. Reuchlin and other men had been influenced by Pico della Mirandola in the last part of the 15th century, that's the 1400s, and a few other men had worked on that too. But the influence was slow in coming, but about 1510, Hebrew burst into the scene, both in Germany and England, as a major study, and in the next 100 years, for scholars to be Hebraists would be quite popular. The difference between them was, some learned their Hebrew by the book, and some learned it from the Jews. And that is the person in academics who learn it from the Jews are the guys that really, you know, they had the reputation. Whether they knew it better or not, I don't know. But they would go and study with a rabbi. Rabbis often used disguise because, and to be a Jew in Europe in those days wasn't always easy. And the rabbis were not always eager to do it. But Jerome, back in the 5th century, had learned it from a rabbi, went and sat with him for months and talked back and forth and spoke affectionately of the rabbi, too, incidentally. And many men did that. Others learned from other people. They were very big on David Kimchi, the Jewish Talmudist of the Middle Ages. Very big on Kimchi, although most Jewish scholars will say that Rashi was the better scholar. I can see that really fascinates your imagination. But they were big on Kimchi. That is not the Korean food. Not the Korean food. That is David Kimchi. Kimchi. He is. The more I say it, the worse it will sound. The Jewish scholar of that particular period. So that by the time we get to the King James age, by the time we get to 1600, Hebrew and Greek had become almost the lingua franca, plural, of the university. Latin was still the great, they talked in Latin, wrote in Latin, sang in Latin, ordered beer at the bar in Latin. But Greek and Hebrew had become the great marks of linguistic skill. And the thing that made men eligible for chairs of authority in England was the fact that they knew Greek and they knew Hebrew. John Boyce, who worked in the King James Bible, was very pleased with the fact that his father had taught him Hebrew fluently and exactly before he was 6 years old. His father had been a scholar, too. And he had learned his father. He had learned it from his father before he was 6 years old. And he had 9 children. He was teaching it to them before they were very old, too. But it had become kind of a medal. And in a circumstance like that, scholars are awfully jealous of their reputation. And in a circumstance like that, the scholarly world, you couldn't make a mistake. There were 15 other scholars ready to point out how dumb you were. Now, obviously, people still make mistakes. I'm merely saying that the age when you get to 1600, academically, the long-lost skills of Hebrew and Greek had been recovered to a fine level of study, which may have exceeded almost anything since. So I don't mean that they meant more. I mean their intensity was like that. So Lancelot Andrews, who also worked in the King James, was fluent in 15 ancient languages. That may not impress you so much. Wilson read a lot of languages. But when I say fluent, I mean that he had mastered the that's what they tell us, the pronunciation. Of course, who could you talk? He didn't know Ugaritic. It hadn't been discovered yet. But who could you go back and talk Mesopotamian with? You know, who would know if you were fluent or not? Might be like me speaking my French to people who've never heard it before. They say, oh, I have a great accent. If a Frenchman walks in the room, I don't say anything after that. It's like a rabbi coming into Hebrew class. You know, you get strangely silent after a while, or rather in a hurry under those circumstances. But I'm just emphasizing that at that point they had attained a degree of study in those things, which gave a lot of people expertise. The English Reformation Bibles in that period were fairly many. Fairly many. I haven't listed them all. I've just listed a few. Tyndale in 1526, he actually got it to the press in 25, but most printers are a little slow in getting things out, you'll discover. The Coverdale Bible, pushed under Henry VIII's permission in 1535. It was very much Tyndale taken over and put together by other people. The Great Bible, put together by Thomas Cromwell and Thomas Cranmer in a very powerful way in 1540. It was put in a great quarto style. You'd take 3 men to carry it. Henry VIII appointed the fact that there should be one in every church. And they discovered they had to chain it to the altar. It would not be there very long, big though it were. But people were hungry for the Word of God. They didn't think anything of stealing a Bible if one showed up loose. The Bishop's Bible is mentioned next, although actually the Geneva Bible precedes it, but it's mentioned next because it's printed in England, the country where we're interested here, 1568. It was printed as England regrouped itself after Bloody Mary's Day, and they were working hard to show that the Anglican Church, the Church of England, was the right church, and the Bishop's Bible moved every stone possible to show that Anglicanism was the true expression of Christianity. They come up with a lot of interesting wordings to do that, some of which show up later in the King James, too. In the meantime, off in Geneva, had been published a very popular Bible, the Geneva Bible. It had been put out by a fellow named William Whittingham and some other people. The New Testament came in 1557, and the full thing came in 1560. They had used heavily some of the initial work of Beza and others, and the Geneva Bible was the most popular English Bible after Tyndale. Tyndale was never completed, of course, but the Geneva Bible was by far the most popular English Bible up to the coming of King James. You can still buy the Geneva Bible. It's still printed. I don't remember exactly what it cost now, but I think it was about $300 a throw, wasn't it?
No, it's down to $99.
Oh, $99. Well, it's sinking fast. But it's a beautiful Bible translation. The chief criticism of it was that it had a lot of notes in the margin and things like that. It also printed in full the verse and chapter, you know, numbers, verse and chapter numbers, which had been hinted at in some of the other Bibles, but hadn't been done thoroughly, because, of course, they're not part of the original text. But the Geneva Bible, which I have read some of it, so I don't own it. It costs more than you have to pay at Woolworths. I'm not likely to show up. But the Geneva Bible was a very popular Bible, written in very good language out of Geneva, and then brought over to England around 1560, just about the time that Elizabeth was gaining the throne in a powerful way. So those English Reformation Bibles were paving the way for the King James Bible, because they gave the precedence that you need a new Bible about every 10 years. They gave the precedence that until there's a Bible that the people are very happy with, you're going to have things after and after that. I mentioned that in the coming of those things, you get these sallies. Sallies, you know, it's an argument back and forth. You get these sallies. I mentioned Moore and Tyndale. I won't read very long. It gets awfully heavy after a while. And it's earlier in the King James period. But it's kind of worth hearing if you like this kind of stuff. And if it's not, you just have to say, I bet those classes are really dull. Anyhow, the argument that there are over is that the writers mistranslate words. That they mistranslate words. And in particular, Thomas More, who is a great scholar, is irritated that Tyndale and the other men translate the word for elders as priest and assembly as church, and the word for love as charity. He's greatly irritated over those things. And Tyndale responds to him by letter. He didn't dare meet him person to person. Responds to him by letter and points out the errors in his own particular thought and thinking. He says this. He says, one thing he rebukes is, I'll just kind of read this in semi-modern English. Another thing he rebukes is that I interpret the Greek word presbyteros by this word senior. Of a truth, senior is no very good English, though senior and junior be used in the universities. But there came no better in my mind at that time. Howbeit, I spied my fault since, long before M. Moore told it me, and have mended it in all the works which I have since made and called it an elder. And in that he maketh heresy of it to call presbyteros an elder. He condemneth their own Latin text of heresy, which only they use yet daily in the church and have said, I suppose, this 1400 years, for that text doth call it an elder likewise. If you can't follow the argument of that, then just forgive me. But in a nutshell, he says, and we're really criticized because we've translated the Greek word presbyteros as senior. Well, you and I don't use senior that way, but we do use junior that way. Once in a while, we'll say, he's my senior. But that's rare. You know, it's much more often you hear somebody say, he's my junior. In fact, you even sometimes name your kids junior. You don't name them that. It just comes out that way. My father was named Tom Taylor, too, but his middle name was DeWitt. Not sure where that came from. Thomas D. Taylor. He wanted to name me after the baseball czar, Kenesaw Mountain Landis. I just think I could have been Kenesaw M.L. Taylor to this day. But in those days, fathers were not present when the children were born. My mother was always very alert when the children were born. And as I was born, and the doctor said, you have a baby. These were home births. The doctor said, you have a baby. My mother said, and he said, I don't know what he said. I don't remember it that well. But I think he probably said, what's this kid's name? Is he have a baby boy? My mother said, call him Thomas. Thomas Vernon, she said. Vernon is the long family name. My father heard about it. He was in a snit for some time. He used to occasionally laugh about years later and call me George, saying he couldn't remember what my name was. But the one thing that everybody in both families was that no matter what they named him, they didn't want a junior around for one reason or another. But when he says, they think it's a heresy, I've translated it senior. But what is a senior bred of presbyteros, he says. And then he said, I realized my error that in modern English, our modern English, elder would be better, and I've translated it that way ever since. Now he says he shouldn't complain at me about that because that's what the Vulgate does. It uses elder too. Said it doesn't go to a Spanish senior, it uses elder too. And consequently, he defends himself against that time after time after time, where the big criticism is over particular words. And it's even more complex with King Gregory Martin, which I will not, again, try to harass you overly with. With Gregory Martin, it's even more complex because Fulk has to argue both sides of these things. And he's very busy arguing with Martin because Martin says this. Martin says, what caused these strange speeches in their English Bible? Here they are. Thou shalt not leave my soul in the grave. Thou hast delivered my soul from the lowest grave. A covetous man is a worshiper of images by laying on to the hands of the eldership. Hail, then he gives a whole bunch more. The grave, he really pounces on that. Have you heard any criticisms of that in the last few years over the translation of Sheol as the grave? No, whatever the case is, Polk says, these speeches are not strange in God's church, however they sound in Martin's ears. So many of them as translate for Sheol, the grave, have their answers, which is appointed for the question. And then he says, the covetous man, a worshiper of image, I've shown in section 5 how that's done. And he goes through, then he talks about the same thing that Tyndale with Presbyterion, suggesting a company of elders, not a company of priests, but a company of elders. And he pushes that further. The signores plebis, the elders of the people, he says. That's what all Romans say too. And they are all born that way. The consistory of elders is the word presbyterium used in Latin. And that seems to end it for him. But without working further on that, I may come back to Martin. Without working further on it, the big criticism is he worked over particular words and translation thrusts. All pre-King James stuff. If you wonder if I'm getting there, I'm going there now. In Roman numeral 2, and the King James Version, appointed but not authorized. We call it the authorized version. But the words that came originally with it were appointed to be read in churches. Parliament never approved it. The king never authorized it in any sense in which he said, you've got to use it, guys. But he appointed it to be read in churches. He didn't give it an exclusive appointment. That would come in time under the hierarchy of the Anglican Church. But he didn't give an exclusive appointment. In fact, it's hard to know how much James really liked it or didn't like it. I shan't get into his character tonight, but he's one of those fellows who could be at church on Sunday morning and out watching the wicked most burlesque in London on Monday night. He's strange in those particular ways. Maybe he's just human, that's all. But whatever the case happens to be, and he met the Puritan. Now, the Puritans are the people in the Church of England who want to make it reformed. They want to make it better. I define that down at the bottom of this page, but I better say a word about it right now. When we talk about Puritans, we're not talking about a separate church. They are members of the Church of England. They just want to get rid of a lot of the Catholic stuff. The candles, the robes, the vestments, lifting up the things of communion. They'd like to get rid of that. They're Puritans, but they're not outside the church. They're not separatists, or they're inside the church. They're Puritans within. They don't want to wear long garments. So when the Puritan bishop shows up for an ordination service, he's usually wearing sackcloth, a kind of a head covering that looks like old burlap, as opposed to the regular bishops who wear satin and linen, radiant colors, and carry a big mitre. Puritan bishop would like to get rid of that, so he'll wear old clothes. It looks like he just came out of the barn, and as a symbol that he opposed that. But they're all part of the Church of England. Understand that. So at Hampton Courts, a number of people met King James. He had been in England for about a year as king. He was James I of Scotland, James VI of Scotland, James I of England. He stands out as a reasonably tall, 5'8" man for his day. Seems to be handsome. He's got a sharp chin, his black eyes. What else can I tell you? Wore a beard and a mustache, and had good points and bad points like most men do, although we mostly know his bad points better, just the way it goes. But there he was. He'd been raised very early in his youth as a Catholic, but the Presbyterians got hold of him when he was a little boy and never let him have any fun for the next 20 years of his life. So his view of Presbyterianism is a dog's life. That's his view. His view of Catholicism is, it must be better because nothing could be worse than Presbyterianism. And since Anglicanism is closer to Catholicism, he kind of likes it too. I'm overstating it a little bit, but not very much. All you could think of in Scotland was on Sunday. All you could do was go to church, read your Bible, and sit. That's all you could do on Sunday. And somehow it didn't impress a little boy. So as he came to England in 1603, he was met by a bunch of people with a petition asking him for reforms in the church. He said he didn't know England very well. He'd meet with them a year later. So in 1604, he met with them at Hampton Courts, which is still in London, and was the palace of Henry VIII. He met with them there, and there they talked over what they wanted to do. I shan't go into the great details of that, but the present out of it particularly was Reynolds, Joshua Reynolds. Joshua Reynolds, the famous cleric of the Church of England. Bancroft, who would be the next Archbishop of Canterbury. And half a dozen other fellows, along with James himself. The prevailing Archbishop of Canterbury, Whitgift, who was very, very sickly and weak, was there. He would die in a few weeks. But he was there to watch over things, and James was there himself. James came in and sat in his own chair, a little separate from the guys, but not on a high throne or high dais, and they talked about it. James discovered that it wasn't easy to talk to the Puritans, because Andrews and Reynolds led the Puritans, and they spoke very sharply against Bancroft and Wycliffe, who led the High Church Anglicans. And it was a bantering kind of thing where they insulted each other back and forth. And now at this point, we don't exactly know what James thought, but what James said is, well, we could have a new Bible, couldn't we? And everybody said, yeah, we'd like to have a Bible. So the Bible translation was a kind of a resolution step against the arguments of the court at that particular time. And without any detail in the plan and execution, James set it up so that there would be three translating sites, one at Westminster in London, one at Oxford, one at Cambridge. Don't even dare to ask who was there. I could tell you, but that makes a long night. Those three translating sites. He had 17 men at Westminster, and those men worked on part of the Old Testament and part of the New. In the Old Testament, they worked from Genesis through Kings. And in the New, they worked from Romans through Jude at Westminster. That was their division. And over at Oxford, he had 15 men at Oxford, and they worked in the Old Testament on the prophets, Isaiah through Malachi, and the things that took place. We're thinking of the way the English Bible is arranged. They worked through those particular books, Isaiah through Malachi, and all the other aspects of the Hebrew Old Testament that came in their direction. And the Gospel people in the New Testament, the New Testament people worked on the Gospel and Acts and the Book of Revelation. And then at Cambridge, the third group met. There were 15 also at Cambridge, and one man who served as kind of a moderator, kind of makes 16, but we're not sure what he did. They worked on the rest of the Old Testament, First Chronicles, through Ecclesiasticus, which means they translated the Apocrypha too. They worked on that, and they worked on the Apocrypha. The New Testament was already done, of course. And it's interesting to note that the Apocrypha was a part of the King James Bible in its first translations, and there were no notes written on it to say, don't read this, guys. But the Anglican Church on the whole did not approve of it on the whole, and when the Westminster Assembly met a few years later, they disapproved of it very heartily. They very emphatically said, we do not regard any of the books of the Apocrypha to be part of sacred or inspired scripture. But that's the way they were. 48 scholars, plus at least 9 others who are referred to from time to time, but we don't know exactly what they did. The secretary of this association was not very precise, but what they did was meet in those groups. They got no added pay for this. How do you like that? You'd think they'd all get rich, but they got no added pay for this. They were all assigned a living in the Church of England, which meant they'd show up at a church on a Sunday and pick up money year by year, but it wasn't enough to make you rich, but they got no added pay for it. And when Mr. Dowse, one of the translators, tried to put in a bill for his travel expenses, they just kind of said, wasn't he doing it for God? God would repay him or something like that, something crude like that. Sounds like modern fundamentalists dealing with their secretarial help. But whatever the case happened to be, they did it out of love for the work and the opportunity. The actual work would begin in 1607. It took them a while to organize and be completed in about 4 years. And one of the points they often made was they were not going to hurry it. They were going to do it slowly and exactly. And they worked through summer and winter, cold days and hot days, and not every week, but 4 to 5 days a week through most of the year. That's what the books tell us anyway. Beyond that, they followed a procedure in which they translated as well as they could and then read their translations back and forth one to another, one man with another, then one man with the whole group. And then when they got through with their particular group with something and thought it was good, they sent that work on to Stationer's Hall. Stationer's Hall was the publishing center that held the reins for this and supplied a lot of the funds for it. You had to have some funds, of course. And when they would work at the hall, then the hall would provide them for lunch and dinner and a few other things along the way. But they would send their work on, and that work would be studied by the group, and then at Stationer's Hall, it would fall under the eyes of 6 men. 6 men who were kind of like a last resort committee at Stationer's Hall. Now, among those was John Boyce. That's B-O-I-S. You'd want to say Woof, but apparently it was pronounced Boys in his day, and sometimes it's spelled like that, and sometimes it's spelled B-O-U-Y-E-S and all sorts of ways. But the only reason I mention Boyce is that Boyce is the only man in the whole group, as far as we know, who kept any kind of record of what they did. And he scribbled it down and scribbled it down and scribbled it down. And then word got out, he kept it private to himself till the day he died. Word got out that Boyce had done it, but it was 300 years before any other scholar saw it. It was kept in a private collection under a man who had been Boyce's close friend. When he died, it came in his hands. Scrivener, writing in 1890, says that, he says, it's hard to imagine the great value this work would be to us if we had it today.
about 30 years after Scrivener's time, it showed up. Showed up in the papers of this English family, and I have this book contains the photocopies of it, which I think you'll look at and say, wow, wow. But actually, if you put your glass on it, look at it for a while, you can read it rather well, allowing for the orthography and the spelling and that kind of stuff. Boys is important for that. He leaves us lots of notes on the words they disputed over, and that kind of interests us too as we move on. But after they looked at it at Stationer's Hall, then it was sent on to a committee of three people, put together of Mr. Bishop Bilson, Bishop Bancroft, and a fellow named Miles Smith. And after they looked over the whole thing, Bancroft took one last look at it. Smith said, Bancroft, he said he didn't trust him a minute. He said he'd change anything he wanted to at the last minute just to make the bishop's position look better. Then it was sent on to Robert Hawker, and he printed it, he printed it in 1611. Printed in 1611, Barker did. He printed two editions in 1611. Now, at this point, I have to stop. I'm not going to stop. I have to point out that under C, difficulties faced, I make a major mistake here in the arrangement of things. Number one, ecclesiastical division is fine. That's no problem. Ecclesiastical division is fine. See, one of the difficulties faced by the King James translators was the division within the church of Puritans and Anglicans. People wanted to reform it, and people wanted to be more Catholic. And along with that, divisions between Calvinists and Arminians. Because the 39 Articles of the Church of England will allow Calvinism or Arminian, they're very ambiguous on that particular point. And there's always been battles in the Church of England between Calvinists and Arminians back and forth at great length. So the Anglican Church is broken up into those parties. There are Puritans who are Calvinists and Puritans who are Arminians. There are Anglicans who are Calvinists and Anglicans who are Arminians. And it makes an unbelievable rearrangement of parties. When your Puritan friend, who's also your Arminian companion, you're a high church person, when you find yourself voting against each other, voting with each other. And if you say politics doesn't enter into these things, politics is about half the name of the game. Now, below that, under one, the next figure should not be A, scholarship. It should just be nothing at all. Just imagine that's not there and go to page two. That should have been erased, but the eraser failed. And on page two, you'll see a B, C, and D. They ought to be written as 2, 3, and 4. Doesn't that give you a feeling of superiority? One is the ecclesiastical problem, the problems they face. Two is the literary problem. The literary problem was that the English language, although this is the crowning age of English literature, the English language lacked in orthography and uniformity, and it lacked an unbelievable amount. Plus the fact it was overrun by vulgarisms, the like you can hardly believe. You've got to go back and read Ben Jonson and those guys in an unexpurgated text to see it. The English mind had sunk to a low level in morality and in expression. We think that's only happened recently, but that's happened off and on in the history of time. And so there was a great literary vacuum, not of literature, but of literature that had good morality. Have you read Shakespeare lately? You don't get many moral lessons in Shakespeare. You get some very dramatic speeches. Is this a dagger I see before me, the handle towards my hand? Come, but doesn't that sound dramatic? You get a lot of stuff, but you don't get many moralizing lectures in Shakespeare, and he rarely refers to the Bible at all. I have a book on the Bible and Shakespeare, and every place that Shakespeare says thus, they assume he copied the thus from the Bible. But it really doesn't go that way. It was a strange thing. Ben Jonson was a great poet, but Jonson wrote some of the most absurd comedies and irritating things to please the king you can hardly imagine. Their censorship concepts were weaker then than they are today. And that is hard to believe, I think. But whatever the circumstances, just take my word for it now and argue later with a professor of English somewhere else. Now, the societal problems. The English society was divided into this very strong clergy block that controlled about three-quarters of the land in England. Then the knights controlled about the other quarter, and you peasants just had to exist as best you could. England was a relatively small country, had about 3 million people, we think, had about 10,000 clergy and various things of that sort. But a big societal problem between the haves and the have-nots. And a big political problem in that a lot of the English people really wished they could get rid of the king and bring back a Catholic to the throne. So you'll remember that they planned to blow James up in what is known as the Guy Fawkes episode. And people watched Guy Fawkes. He was building a fire and warming himself in the street and in the alleyway below the big Parliament building. And people did things like that because the homeless in those days made the homeless today look like nothing. So Guy Fawkes was known not to have a F-A-W-K-S. He was known not to have a great deal, but he's warming himself. He's building a fire against the wall. He's warming himself. And they tell him to go away and cut that out, and they run him off one or two times, and finally somebody hears that there's a plot against the king, and they go, and there's Guy Fawkes building a fire, warming himself, and so they haul him off to prison. But behind the thin wall behind his fire, they found, I don't remember how many, but it's an enormous number of kegs of gunpowder behind the wall where Fawkes is building his fire. Thin, thin wall. And they had visions that when James would address Parliament the next day, which he was supposed to do, they had visions that just about that time, with a long fuse and that fire, they'd have blown the place to smithereens. Well, Fawkes did not have a long life. Long enough to be tortured till he told who his compatriots were. And most of them were arrested and tortured and executed and all that sort of stuff. But that political thing put everything into a stew. And consequently, you're working to do your Bible translation in a world where there's a great social upheaval, a moral situation that's almost a morass, and a political situation in which thoughts of treason and tension run high all the time. It does not make a good age for work. But as I mentioned, it had a background of study and production. Well, how about the criticisms themselves? I've boiled the criticisms down into five groups of the King James in its time. The first of those is concerning the translators. You'll think you've heard this before. The standard criticism was that the translators were not the best scholars available. And everybody who said it could think of somebody else to mention. The nonconformist, David Jacob, I don't think you have to worry with his name, there's no test on this, but the nonconformist, David Jacob, went through the list, found that none of them really were smart. In spite of Andrew's learning and Boy's learning, none of them were really smart. He took particular objection to Bilson, whom he said could not be trusted with anything, Greek or Hebrew or anything else. Now, the fact that he was a nonconformist may have helped his opinion a little bit like that. Hugh Broughton, who was an Anglican Puritan, but was not selected to be one of the translators and was thought to be one of the finest Hebrew scholars of the time in England, he sniped at a good many of them. He looked at Bilson, and he looked at a fellow named Blaney and Lively. He looked at those fellows and said no one of them could be trusted. He said it saddens me to think that anyone will ever use this poor and miserable work. The scholarship of the translators is very heavily attacked. And there are other reasons in that. I don't know how to say that. I could read you a lot of quotes, but I'll just tell you that though the men themselves were the heads of departments and universities and everything else, there were other people around who were smart, and they criticized the scholarship. Now, they didn't criticize the scholarship of everybody. They picked on a few and then pointed out that those few would really paralyze the work of the whole. And unfortunately, death comes in here because people died then as they do today. So although the committee was appointed in 1606, more or less, it began its work in 1607. Actually, by the time it began its work, at least five of the original appointees had died. Several others would die after that. Some did not die. Some lived a long time. Bishop Chatterton lived 50 years after they finished the work. He lived to be 103, preaching till the time of his death. It's funny how those things go. Preaching out of the Geneva Bible at the time, but up to the time of his death. But whatever the circumstance happened to be, then they had to replace those men. So, you know, when you've already said we've got the very best men there are, and five of them die, who are you going to get? You have to get five pumpkins. You know, you've already got the very best. Who are you going to get? Well, they certainly weren't going to select Broughton or any of those guys that criticized them. And I'm not saying the replacements weren't good. We don't exactly know who replaced who. All we have is a list of 48 names, 9 other names, 1 name beside that, and we don't have much on them apart from the degrees they held in the universities they worked at. The lifestyle. This is the 17th century, and they said that Thomas Ravis, one of the translators, was nothing but a party boy. He was the bishop, an English bishop, and I think, from what I read, a good man. But you know, almost everybody drank alcoholic beverages then. Do you know that? Almost everybody did. People died from drinking the water in London. They didn't know that that's why they were dying, but I'm not saying they were all stoned. I'm saying that they just drank it. It was regularly reported that Ravis enjoyed it too much. And they were better off in the Roman church, where they had to finish the communion wine themselves when the service was over. These guys could share it later if they wanted. But a number of men were criticized for their lifestyle. Some even criticized Reynolds. They said he had too much to drink. And, of course, the defenders of that point out that you can always criticize at great length. That isn't the essence of it. You need to have some ground and reason behind it. And then the fact that some good men were not included, Archbishop Usher, for example, a fellow who did the chronological work, and Hugh Broughton and some others. And then, of course, there was just the general prejudice that some people thought the Geneva Bible was so good it could never be improved on, and some of the bishops thought the bishop's Bible was so good that they didn't need the Geneva Bible. So that prejudice is always a big factor. Prejudice in criticism is hard to weigh because nobody almost will admit it. Nobody will just look up and say, well, I'm biased, and that's it. Don't show me any facts. I'm biased. I struggle with it myself. Nice, open-minded chap like me, I struggle with it myself. I like the King James Bible. I continue to use it for my preaching and teaching. I don't mind a new King James. I can use the NIV if they want me to. In fact, if a church said, you know, we use the... If a church said we use anything, I can use it. But that's where my Bible memory work is done. That's where I enjoy it. And I hate to look down at the page and see something that isn't the way I remember it. So I've kind of enjoyed it. And I will admit, when somebody says, well, what do you think about this particular Bible? The first thing in my mind is prejudice. That's all. Just prejudice. But the only thing I'll say for it is that the guys who translate it should be called Bible writers, not Bible translators. I've said that a lot of times. It's a nasty, slurry thing to say, and I apologize. But they keep changing it too, you know. And that's good. They did that for the King James at the start, and that helped to make it what it was. And if they keep changing the NIV enough, at the rate they're now going, in about 200 years, it will be a possible where I will be satisfied with it. I can't remember the fellow's name at Gordon now, but he was a big NIV pusher and translator. But when he wrote his commentary on Corinthians, his side notes on the text, again and again in the NIV text, he says, I can't understand how they did it. I can't understand how they did it. And words to that effect. But I like it. I read it every morning for breakfast. I read through it a couple times a year. You have to be, well, I try to read through it. I missed it a little bit, but I'm pretty close. But I read through it at breakfast, and I read the King James for my devotions, and my study, that kind of stuff. And once I worked through the NASV, and I, you know, NASV, I almost died in that. I think it's, well, never mind. You can see I have prejudice. You see, I have prejudice. Well, work with yourself and enjoy the Scripture. Enjoy the Scripture. I like the New King James, and I like the NIV in its place. But. After I've read the Hebrew, I shouldn't read the Hebrew or Greek if I'm going to use the NIV. I shouldn't do it. I ought to just stay with the English by itself. Oh, witnessed uncertainties. Witnessed uncertainties. Criticism of the King James. Witnessed uncertainties. In 1611, two editions appeared to the King James. And two printings. The second printing, now I can't tell you exactly how many differences there were between it and the first printing, but there's a considerable number. And the humorous ones that most of the books pick out, because they like to, I've got seven books here, three of them use the same illustrations, right? They all copy from each other, I guess, is the passage where Ruth gets all the barley given to her in Ruth 3:15. And the Masoretic text, didn't bring it up, the Masoretic text plainly says, the Masoretic text plainly says, and he went into the city. But the great majority of the other Hebrew manuscripts say, and she went into the city. And you go back and look and say, well, did Boaz do it? Well, it seems plain she went in. You'd say, well, why would the earlier Hebrew text? Oh, who knows why? Who knows why? But the first publication in 1611 said, and he went into the city, along with a number of other gender changes in Ruth. And the second one said, and she went into the city. You say, that's a little thing. Yeah, it is a little thing. But it shows you that the original work that Smith edited and the men published, it shows you that it wasn't finished to the point where they thought nothing could be done on it. It shows you that. And so the publication, the printing that comes out in 1614, my book says, Scrivener lists all these things in his book on the Authorized Version, but the one that came out in 1614, Scrivener counts 400 changes in the translation from the one that came out in 1611. That's in 3 years. You just have to bear that in mind, I think, as you pass. But the concept of the variety of versions and changes indicates that they were very much oppressed by what we call witness uncertainty. Somebody write and say, hey, you translated Presbyteros as senior in this passage and elder in that passage. The guys would look at it and say, well, we can go back and change that. In fact, in the first edition, there were 20-some places where they weren't really sure what the Greek meant, and they just kind of left those places blank. Be filled in as time went on. Now they continue to work on it, however, and I mentioned that they revised it in 1629, 1638, and 1645. Parliament wanted to revise it, but ran out of time, so they didn't get it done. Remember, the revolution was on then. They revised it in 1683, had a minor revision in 1701, big revision in 1762, and the last big revision by Blaney in 1769. Now, that was the mistake. I mean, if there was ever a mistake, that was the mistake. The revisions were not giant things. Corrections in spelling, orthography, translation of a word here and there, change of a text, but small things. But you can read the defense of this in Hill's book, you know, The Defense of the King James, but the thrust of it is when somebody says, well, you know, God only wrote one Bible, and it's a King James Bible. Don't be mad at me for this, because I'm user of it. But I always say to them, well, which one of all those revisions did God write, you know? Or, of course, they kind of think maybe God kept revising on and up. But nobody who uses the King James today uses the King James of 1611. Nobody does. You can't get close to it today unless you own one of them. Now, 3 years ago, the owner of the Schuylkill Book and Curio Shop in Philadelphia audited a barn of books in Buckingham. When I say a barn of books, there's like 36,000 old books stored in the barn. And a wealthy fellow from Philadelphia had died. And the estate people in Philadelphia had this man. They were antique and ancient books. Now, this is a big talking fellow, so I listened to him talk. And he told how in it he found three first edition King James Bibles. Three first edition. He said one of them was worth $76,000 at the auction. And then he said, I found a fourth one, he said, that didn't have a flyleaf in it. He said, I know it's an original, but he said, it doesn't have a flyleaf. And without the flyleaf, he said, you might as well forget it. But he said, I know it's original. So he let me look at one of these. It was kind of large. He watched me while I looked at it. A friendly fellow, judo expert, but he watched me while I looked at it. Of course, it was very hard to read. The printing was old and the ink and all that kind of stuff, hard to read. But I didn't realize there had been two versions in 1611, I mean two printings in 1611. And he said to me, with great authority, he said, this is the first printing. I thought he meant 1611, but what he meant was it was the first of the two printings in 1611. That's what he meant. Kind of an interesting sort of thing. Well, I don't know what's happened to him or to King James Bible. I know what happened to one with no flyleaf in it. He took it all apart and sold the pages of it to people on plaques, you know, decoupage plaques. For so many dollars, you could have a decoupage plaque of the King James. I can't tell you the full story of that. It gets ludicrous after a while. I said, that was a smart thing to do. No, he said it was a stupid thing to do. He said, everybody wanted the 23rd Psalm and John 3, he said, and I had to send back more money than I got. Oh, I said, that's too bad. No, he said, that was good. He said, I could go on about eight more good and bad for him. Finally, I just shut up and let him finish the story, and we were all happier that way. But those are the witnessed uncertainties. Big criticisms, see. Now, we have the same thing with the NIV. I'm not going to pick on it, but I think they do right. I think they do right to correct things, so I commend them for that. But I have assigned Bible memory work in some of the courses here, and I said to the student, whatever Bible you use for your daily study is okay for the Bible memory work. Isn't that what I said? Yes. Yes, and I think that's fair to the student. Last year, the first year I said that, I had five Bibles being used for memory work. So when I get this memory work written out, I had to get these Bibles out of the library and study it. And 2 years ago, when I had some Korean brethren whose English was not good, I said, if you want to memorize it in Korean, I said, that's all right. I said, the thing is, I want you to know it. That was a bad mistake. You'll forgive me, Miss Choi, but that was a bad mistake. They wrote it beautifully. So what I did was get the help of one of the Korean brothers who went up to the library and made photocopies of those pages of the Korean Bible. One of the brethren helped me. And then I would go down on my light thing downstairs, and I would lay the photocopy on one side and lay their printed copy on the other side and see if it looked somewhat similar. It took about half an hour per paper. And once in a while, I found big mistakes. Would you believe it? At least they looked totally different. I put a big circle around it. Nobody ever came back and said, I think you're wrong about this, Professor Dale. But the following year, see, you can be dumb once. You shouldn't be dumb all the time. The following year, I said, it will be done in English. I still let them use whatever Bible they wanted as long as it was an English Bible, because that year I had a Spanish fellow and a bunch of other guys. I could just see endless grief. But those are the witnessed uncertainties. The third area of criticism, the divisionary concepts in the translation community. I mean by that the translators often fought among themselves. Now, fight isn't the right word, but use a better word. And then they were good enough to make it public. So that Miles Smith was said of Bishop Bancroft. Bancroft was kind of an Archbishop of Canterbury. And he said of Bancroft, he said he changed it in 14 places after everything was done just to enforce his ideas of the bishopric. Bancroft is the man responsible for the expression of Judas Iscariot the translation, let another man take his bishopric. Bancroft liked that bishopric. They had his place and his position and all sorts of things. But Bancroft liked that. He said 14 places, he said. He just arbitrarily changed the text to satisfy his high church tendencies. He spoke of him as a man that couldn't be trusted with a pen or a lot of other things. There was not tons of that because, I mean, there was no doubt a good deal more, but we see it in Boyce's notes. We see in Boyce's notes how one man came in with a translation. Many of those, there are a great many of them are in this book, incidentally, but one man came in with one translation, another fellow came in with another one, and they'd sit there and chew each other over who had the better wording of it. Those things often occur even in modern times today. The structural criticisms, I mentioned three particular ones. The commitment to the bishop's Bible. That was one of the first rules given to the translators, that they had to stay as close to the bishop's Bible as possible. James didn't want to pick it up one morning and look at it in the first chapter, the first verse would say, and once upon a time there was no world, so God said, let's have one. He didn't want to see that, so he didn't want to have that. He didn't want to have any approximate translations, so they were to say they were to follow the wording of the bishop's Bible. That proved absolutely impossible, because the bishop's Bible is a static kind of thing, overly literal in spots and not so pejorative as some, but just not a good translation. I mean, from that point of view, not a good English translation. See, there can be good translations in that the translation sense is there, but if you can't understand it when you read it, then it's bad news. So there was a fair amount of criticism on that line. Likewise, their partiality towards Tyndale. Now, many critics said that the King James Bible was nothing but Tyndale, just slightly warmed over again. Well, there is a lot of Tyndale in it, I think, because Tyndale had a genius gift from God in translation. And Tyndale also knew you had to revise and do things over again. He felt that you needed a lot of time before you put it out, like these men did. But everybody knew that if you waited until it was perfect to produce it, you would never get it out. That's a keen thing to remember. If you're going to write your memoirs and they have to be perfect, you might just as well save your time and collect stamps. They won't get out. I mentioned also the structure with regard to the punctuation quirks. A lot of the punctuation was done with Smith. You know, Greek and Hebrew have no original punctuation in them. The Hebrew punctuation goes back to about 600, 700 AD when it was placed in the text. Most of it. There's a tiny bits of it that are earlier than that. And of course, the Greek punctuation comes with Erasmus and all those guys. We had a lot of fun with old Greek texts. Mr. Harding and I, years ago, we thought we were reading the Psalms in the Alexandrian text, Dr. Newman, but after we worked for a while, we discovered we were reading the Solomon, the Psalms to Solomon and the Apocrypha. We had to work through about three Psalms to figure that out. Because, of course, all the words run together, and there is no punctuation, there's no verse markings, there occasionally is a break or something like that. So what we were doing was looking for those psalm titles. When we came to a psalm title, we'd say, aha, we're at the end of something, and then we would look to see what it was. We never could quite figure out what a couple of them were. That's because we were in the apocryphal book, the Psalms of Solomon. And if you say to yourself, how can you be so dumb? Well, there's no heading on the tops of the pages. There's just the poems. You know, you could see they're in the poetic, Greek poetic form. Just a poem, what would you have done? It was all we were in the Psalms. No numbers, you know, just not in the Psalms. But we were, that's a long time ago. I hope he remembers it the way I do. I remember that he was the one who discovered the problem. Whatever the case is, we were looking for psalm titles in the Alexandrian text, Alexandrian codex. And so Smith put a lot of them in. Smith is the fellow who put the famous comma in Isaiah 9:6, which the Hebrew does not sustain at all. His name shall be called Wonderful Counselor. And Payne, writing his book on the men behind the King James Version, says, just think, if Smith hadn't done that, Handel couldn't have written the Messiah. Do you remember how it goes, Wonderful Counselor? But actually the Hebrew holds together with a conjunctive accent and says, Wonderful Counselor. And then there's a comma, Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God. But Smith was fond of the comma, and Payne notes that Smith was reported to have continued to work on these things even when he was riding in his carriage. Dr. McRae used to tell us that the man who divided the Bible into chapters did that. And he'd be sitting on his horse getting ready to write, and the horse would step in a hole, and he'd lunge forward and mark a chapter division. Now, that probably is apocryphal, but Payne says of Smith that he worked on it night and day. When he took a trip, he took along and worked with it, and so he was overly fierce in punctuation. And when you're reading the King James, you're largely reading Smith's punctuation, somewhat revised. But a lot of times you'll see a sentence, you say, this is much too long. Other times you'll see one in Hebrews 12, that long sentence in Hebrews 12, You ought to be stopped about three times, but you can't tell most congregations that today, because most congregations, you know, think that the point that God put the periods and that sort of stuff in. I'm not saying that Smith didn't do a good job, but there was a lot of criticism over it. A lot of criticism. So we're not just talking about the New Testament, we're talking about the whole Bible. And that's quite an impressive piece of work. It took these men just 9 months after the translations were finished to do all their proof texting, all their reading, all their discussion, and all their correction work. 9 months. They worked at it. One time, scholars said it was impossible to do that, but when they picked up these notes by boys and found some of the records of days and found the sources that were used, they discovered that the chief source that was used with regard to a number of books had been written early in 1911. So they say they had it like January. So they had it early in the year. They couldn't have been doing it in 1910 or they wouldn't have had it. So they got it ready and got it to the printer, all that kind of stuff. Well, work at that at your leisure, I think. Structural criticism and the last criticism were the assaults of scholars, of whom there are always a lot of those guys. They are never ending bound. Some of us are not scholars. We just become snide authorities that don't always say what we ought to say. But the attacks of scholars are fairly heavy, and I shan't read anything of those to you. But sometimes the attacks came early enough for people to make changes. And there's nothing wrong with that, because you can't get it perfect at the start, and some changes have to be made. Broughton was the outstanding scholar who spoke against it very heavily. He said he couldn't go to sleep at night thinking about people being misled by using it. But after 6 or 7 years, he mellowed too. Now, in a nutshell, you'll see that those criticisms are the criticisms that are almost made every age with every Bible that's produced. I'm just looking at the wall for emphasis. Almost every Bible that's produced. And liberals on the scholarship board, men themselves can't decide what the final words are. They change it the next time they put it out. They argued among themselves. They weren't faithful to this aspect or that aspect, and they weren't scholarly enough in their approach to things. You'll find that those are about always used. And there's some justification for all of them and every translation's ever made, because the translations are done by people. By people. And we were really pretty hard in the RSV. I don't have much sympathy for it, although it's much more literal than some other Bibles are. And reading it with hindsight, it has a lot of good translations in it. It's just got some that really almost make you ill, but it's got some really good translations in it too. But the concept is that we had an emotional reaction to other Bible translations. I remember when I first read J.B. Phillips. Yeah, I could hardly wait to put it down. The New Testament and Modern Spirit, J.B. Phillips. No, I went through a funny change of life. I read Phillips' autobiography. Read of his conversion and other things, and read of what he wanted to do with the scriptures. Then I went back and read it again, and suddenly it read pretty good to me. I read fairly often. I have a nice little Phillips New Testament. I read from it fairly often and kind of enjoy it. So in life, there are some things you have to pick up on like that. If we could wait before we shoot in the criticism business, we would be better off. It's hard to do that. I'm anxious to plug those rebels as quick as I can. So you pull out your .45 and fire away twice. Kill a few innocent bystanders in the way that the bullet just passes through them. So I don't know where we're headed, but I thought those were interesting, those criticisms in the 17th century. And if I've given you too much background stuff and other things, just chalk that up to profit and loss. But my criticisms are in these five major areas. And if anything else, they ought to teach us to be fair and to be disciplined, fair and disciplined and judicious in our critiques of people attempting to translate the Word of God. I still don't like the cotton patch version. And I'm appalled by today's English Bible a lot of times. But what I ought to do is say, look, it took the King James Bible 50 years to become the favorite Bible in England. 50 years. Most of the men who translated it and who have left us written sermons, there are about 20 of them, I think, show no indication of using it regularly in their sermons. Just an occasional man here and there. Dr. Dowse refers to it occasionally and refers to other Bibles too. So it took about 50 years. It took a revolution in England. It really didn't gain great popularity until Charles I came back after 1560. And from 1560 up until 1900, it was the ruling Bible in English literature. But for people who say, you know, there is no other Bible, well, it's hard to know what all those Germans were doing in those days. You know, they didn't read English that well. I'm feeling very snide tonight. And, of course, while they made reference to Erasmus's text, they also relied heavily on the text work of Theodore Beza. And a couple other guys, too. I don't think I really need to say anything else.